Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, hello, my habibis and habibtis. Welcome to this very special episode of Jin's Podcast, the very first podcast that tackles love, feminism, gender, and sexualities for the Arabs and or Muslims of this world. Today, I want to talk to you about the media, the way information is conveyed, and all the biases that riddle the truth of what happens around the globe. In the era of Trump spewing insanities without being punished for it, Facebook, Instagram, Google, Apple, and Amazon knowing our tastes better than we might do, ChatGPT reading into our minds, and AI-powered deepfake videos, less and less viewers trust the news and don't believe anymore in getting closer to the truth. This is how climate change skeptics or conspiracy theorists feel. The so-called truth is said to be one-sided, biased, orchestrated. But it's funny how this criticism is generally drawn towards Arab and Muslim reporters or journalists. Western media quite easily demonizes and gaslights Arab and Muslim journalists, perhaps even more so when they are also citizens of a Western country. The media today need to be square with their willful intention of transparency, accountability, and storytelling, as so far as they are essential values for any journalist who reports the news, especially when it's news from the Middle East. Today, most media in the West are trading in nuance for quick, simple, low-attention news that are actually just headlines. Arab and Muslim journalists who want to own their storytelling about love, gender, sexualities, human rights, politics, or social justice are being frowned upon by Western media because it might not follow their agenda of narrating a fantasized Orient, as Edward Said once explained, wherein every building is destroyed by soldiers, tyrants are running the country, exotic and attractive women are submissive, queer people are executed, and human rights are not as respected as in modern, advanced, and forward-looking countries of the West. So today, I'm super glad to welcome on Jins, a superstar of journalism, Ahmed Shihabuddin. Ahmed is an Emmy-nominated journalist, producer, and actor. He is known for a documentary investigation with the BBC called Queer Egypt Under Attack. Prior to that, he worked as a senior correspondent for AG+, where he produced award-winning documentaries focused on social justice and human rights. Previously, Ahmed worked as a reporter and producer for Al Jazeera English, as well as for the New York Times, the Huffington Post, and PBS. Ahmed is widely known for creating and co-hosting Al Jazeera English's flagship program, The Stream, an interactive live talk show nominated for an Emmy Award for Most Innovative Program in 2012. Dear Habibi Ahmed, thanks for accepting my invitation on Jins.
My pleasure.
So Ahmed, how do you connect to your roots and your faith as an Arab-American Muslim who lived in Egypt and Austria and who has Palestinian and Kuwaiti roots? Did you experience racism or some kind of Islamophobia?
I like that you asked this question first because maybe like some of your listeners, I always felt like an outcast somehow or an outsider as a kid. You know, growing up in the Arab world, I was super aware of how westernized I was. And then in the US and Europe, I was somehow made to feel very aware of how Arab I was. And I think this sort of juxtaposition, this identity conflict, and all of the microaggressive and macro sort of bigger, more overt racist confrontations, sort of the identity conflict that triggered constantly is a product of how, you know, we're perceived in each context. And I think it's how we imagine we're judged. You know, I was born in the US, but I didn't move there or live there until I was 17 when I moved to Boston the year after 9/11. So it wasn't the best time to be a young Arab guy named Ahmed Rakan Shahabuddin. In fact, my full name is pretty intense when translated. It translates to blessed prophet knight shooting rocket of religion. So that's a lot of pressure. Thank you, mom and dad. Many of us can relate to this sort of confluence of backgrounds and conflicting identities, and we're proud of them, even though in many ways they're a source of a lot of what can hold us back, what can limit us, and what can often represent the voice in our head that tells us we can't do something. The one thing I'll say to answer your question about faith, people assume because I'm Ahmed, my name is Ahmed, that I must be, you know, the most pious Muslim man. People tend to project things on you based on your identifiers. But for me, it's not that I'm not religious. It's just that organized religion has always been something I have questioned since I was a kid. I'm blessed to have a mom who's very faithful in many definitions of the word. So I learned from her when I was young. One of the things she used to always say is "علاقتك بينك وبين ربك وبس," which is, you know, and you don't let, and you know, your relationship between you and God is between you and God, and that's it. So over the years, I think I've nurtured my faith through loss and failure, and through blessings and gratitude, and I've come to really believe in the divine. But my faith resonates in the teachings more of Sufism, which I think emphasizes an inward search for God and sort of shuns materialism. Rumi's poetry of love and life has always helped me sort of ask the questions that led me to a more fulfilled, faithful life. Sufism, you know, for me, is really about emphasizing introspection versus following anyone. I feel closest to God when I'm in Mother Nature. And I think it's not lost on me that we call Mother Nature by the feminine, the sort of divine feminine. In the US, it was very clear to me when I moved there after 9/11. And since then, I've spent 15 years working there for mainstream news organizations, just existing as an Arab. My Arabness and my Muslimness, if you will, because they're equated, it was seen as a source of shame or a threat to society, some sort of inherent threat. You know, I'll never forget the first few weeks of undergraduate school at Boston University. I had a huge Palestinian flag in my dorm room. And as it were, girls would come by my room flirtatiously asking me questions. And, you know, they'd be like, "Oh, my God, I love your flag. Where's it from?" And I'd be like, "Oh, I'm Palestinian." Like, "Oh, Pakistanian?" I say, "No, I'm Palestinian." And then they say, "Oh, my God, is that like in Afghanistan?" And I say, "No, but, you know," and they say, "Oh, but there's a war there, right?" I'm like, "Yeah, sort of. It's an occupation." "Oh, so you mean Iraq?" Because Bush had just invaded. I say, "No, but there's also an occupation in Iraq." "Oh, but like you sound like so American and like so modern." And that's usually when those conversations would end. But with this aspect of my identity came more and more under attack. And so, you know, the reality is, Jamal, it's not possible to escape other people's ignorance or their racism or discrimination, but you can change and manage how you react to your emotions and how you process it and internalize it or don't, you know? And I think for a lot of my life in my 20s, I really didn't have the boundaries and I didn't have the sort of conviction to not allow it to define my identity. And by defining my identity, it caused me quite a bit of suffering, you know?
One thing that always shocks me is that other media might portray you as a monolithic character, as a spokesperson for all Arabs and all Muslims, because obviously it's kind of the same thing, isn't it? But also because you speak your mind, you switch into an embodiment of the quote-unquote angry barbarian who masters the language of the civilized world and uses it as a weapon. You basically weaponize your knowledge. How do you manage to make this fallacious archetype disappear?
I think it's a fantastic question because it reminds me of sort of Mohammed al-Kurd, who I think has a very strong viewpoint on how people, you know, frame him and his talent. But that said, it was always clear to me that objectivity in the context of media and my career was sort of like a privilege afforded to sort of white authoritarian style centralized media. And I'm not trying to racialize the media, but let's be honest, like, you know, I always knew that my language, my experiences, the person I am, would invariably affect not only how, if I'm honest with myself, like most journalists, how I report a story, what I choose to focus on, what I don't, but also how my story is going to be perceived, particularly if I'm Palestinian, if I'm marginalized in another way. And so, you know, yeah, there were many times when I was confronted with forms of racism at the New York Times and elsewhere that were so overt. It was not just offensive, but obscene, you know, and also like sometimes on CNN, whenever there would be like some sort of explosion in the Arab world or some sort of eruption of violence, you know, they would call me and they would use on the lower third, like in the description, Muslim journalist, like, and they'd basically just expect me to apologize on behalf of quote unquote moderate Muslims. Like, you know, it's about flipping the script. It's about working through, like I used to put on social media this story, you know, in which my identity is the foundation, you know, where I kind of defined myself based on my location, my career, my legacy, and all these other paradigms that ultimately don't really mean much, even if we're conditioned to believe they should mean everything, like Palestinian by blood, American by birth, Kuwaiti by nationality, Egyptian by upbringing, Austrian by adolescence. The really only one that I think is consistently true is curious by nature.
So we are 22 years after 9/11, after wars in Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, after Charlie Hebdo's attacks, yet Muslims are held responsible for what's going wrong with this word. And it's not just Republicans or far-right movements or white supremacists. So how do you personally gauge the Islamophobic sentiment in the Western countries right now?
No, that's so well put. I mean, yeah, it's part of why I choose to identify as a recovering journalist, because it's been so exhausting in one sense. But, you know, the thing about racism for me is it's been such a constant in my life, whether Islamophobia, racism, any form of discrimination, like, and I think it works in many different ways. Like, you know, in Europe, it was always because, you know, like the year I moved from Egypt to Austria, I was 14. And it was 1999, and Jörg Haider was in power. He was called the neo-Nazi, but really just a young Nazi. And there were people who would spit on me on the trains, on the subway, people singing songs in German about me leaving, like Auslande, lass mein Stadt zu schnell zu kann, like all these things, get out of my country. So, you know, I'm not trying to play the victim here, but being very young, trying to figure out your place in the world, you know, it occurred to me very quickly that there's a lot of hatred that's just born out of sheer ignorance. And I think that's what happened to me in Europe when I was 14. And then again, when I was in the US, when I was 17, until I was 30 and throughout. So I think I would be dishonest if I said that it didn't play like a role in why I chose to pursue journalism, like those young experiences, for example, on the tram in Austria, like kids spitting on me and like everybody in the tram, old women hitting me with their canes, making a dog stand up, like making me stand up from my seat so they can place their dog in my seat. Like these very sort of aggressions when you're 14 in a new country, it certainly has a lasting effect on how you perceive yourself and your role in the world, but also how you perceive others. It's like what Angela Davis says, like it's in a racist society, it's not enough to be non-racist. We must be anti-racist. And the truth is in the Arab world, there's also a lot of, you know, I was stuck in Kuwait during COVID and just the kind of overt racism I saw between Arabs, amongst Arabs in Kuwait against Egyptians, the racism against Black people, which is also very alive and well in the Arab world, you know, where we have the longest slave trade. So for me, it's like, it's what you said, like, I got so tired of being cast as the angry Arab, the person who is misunderstood, misrepresented. They want you to be angry because that fits sort of, yeah, the narrative through this lens of terror, through this inherent sort of violence.
Yeah, but at some point for me, it's not just like pure ignorance, it's also chosen ignorance.
I think it starts with checking our own biases and being a bit reflective and understanding what motivates us to tell the kind of stories that we tell. I think motivation is a very powerful measure of the possible impact of telling stories. So, you know, for as much as when there's crisis and chaos with Israeli aggression in Palestine or anything in the Arab world, I tell those stories and I share them because I think they're important for visibility and for factual documentation. But I think so much of the stories that we might overlook or that we don't often focus on are the stories that inherently humanize. And I know this seems a bit obvious, but that inherently humanizes Arab people, Muslims, people who are persistently and consistently dehumanized by the media. It's been about trying to shift perceptions away from the dogma and division and to connect with people through storytelling, through compassion and connection. I think, you know, when we can shine a light on the truths about our collective human condition, both in suffering and in joy, then that really unites us across the boundaries and the barriers that separate us. And so, you know, I think for so many of us, we're more comfortable sort of trying to treat symptoms of suffering rather than exploring the source. I think the reason you have in the West this sort of willful ignorance, I experienced this even in the last documentary I did in Egypt about sort of young queer people in Egypt, is sometimes there's this challenge and this inability almost to see what you can't see and feel what you can't feel. And that sounds cheesy, but what I mean is this Western, if you will, perspective on issues in the Arab world can often be a bit narrow and myopic. Whether intentionally or not, I think it's born out of this belief that Arabs are a monolith, ignorance, like you said, a lack of education.
It feels like Western media coverage of the Muslim world is stuck in a sort of Bermuda Triangle between miserabilism, despotism, and Orientalism. Sometimes when I watch some media in France or in the US, I could swear there's a clear intent to dehumanize entire populations in the way they're described. It's like it's in their culture, or worse, in their nature, that they'd be violent for men and submissive for women. It's either they're repulsive because of their ugliness, savagery, and backward habits, or they're desirable, luxurious, and exotic. So this is my question. When will Western media get out of this triangle?
For some people, like people who don't know who they are without this victimized identity, you know, there's this quote by Charles Cooley that's like, I'm not who you think I am. I'm not who I think I am. I am who I think you think I am. That's why, like, I'm very inspired to do stories about people, about human beings that are shifting away from sort of traditional or normative identities in order to create shifts in their communities. And like some of the last documentaries I did while I was at AJ Plus were about this, you know? And that's where I find, like, people always say to me, oh, you're so political, because I think I fundamentally believe in human rights and equality. I also fundamentally am aware that there's such selective bias when it comes to upholding or championing human rights, not just with Palestinians, but with so many groups. So for me, I'm always a bit surprised, like when I travel and I meet strangers and their perception of me is, you know, what they see on Instagram, and they always perceive me as so political. And I hate politics. I think it's so filthy. I think my mom always used to say to me, don't go into politics. And it's like, I never intended to. I didn't know that like caring about human rights and other people is political inherently.
It's good that you talk about it, because as an activist, I've been fighting for queer rights in the MENA region alongside with other incredible and dedicated people. Unfortunately, laws in most Arab countries are still very coercive and against same gender love and sexuality. So you've directed a documentary on queer people in Egypt who are undergoing, since the COVID lockdowns, waves of police-led witch hunting. Some civilians even trap and beat down LGBT plus people themselves. All of that knowing that in Egypt, there's no specific law in the penal code condemning homosexuality, but they classify it as debauchery.
A BBC News investigation has revealed how criminal gangs are using dating apps to find vulnerable people online and how they rob, film, and extort their victims for money.
So why is it urgent to raise awareness about queer rights in the region?
I really appreciate this question because so many people who care about me in my life have questioned my willingness and attempts to humanize this community, the queer community, because it comes with consequences, as you know, and it's not popular in many, many countries. I think the answer is simple, if I'm honest with you. For me, all human rights are tied together. So all of our human rights are dependent on each other, men, women, gender, like whatever human rights, right? And so I truly believe it's important to normalize this very simple truth, which is, you know, I know there are attempts to dehumanize, to say that queer people are terrorists, to frame them as something inherently foreign or Western. These are very silly things, but they come with serious grave consequences. Like, these are people like all of us. They are in our communities. They're in our homes. They're your brothers and sisters and cousins and your parents sometimes and your children. So for me, that's the reality. And that these people are human and that their perceived crime is that they love the way they feel God intended for them to love. I know that may be a controversial statement, but if you interview, you know, there's this cancel culture that we live in where it's like, if you're queer, that means you don't believe in God. You can't be queer and Muslim. You can't be queer and Christian. You can't be queer. It's like we don't want to ostracize this community that is still very much on a spiritual journey of their own. And so for me, I think the experience of reporting this documentary in Egypt and some of the other work I've done that's similar has come at a high cost, but it's something that I'm very proud of because it's not easy to do.
Another community that is very, very ostracized and beaten down is Palestinians. So you've always been quite vocal about Palestine. And because it's an episode about the media, we've been seeing Vogue, the magazine, erasing the word Palestine from Instagram posts about Gigi Hadid, who's got Palestinian roots as well. So how can Western journalists take up the challenge of covering Palestinian news without any bias or at least without concealing the truth?
The truth is no one is objective, right? And I think it's important to start there because, you know, for me, when it comes to Palestine, there's such an obvious and overt attempt to both sides the situation, to erase the disproportionate power dynamic, to completely remove the context of the ethos and of Zionism and what the Israeli state actually believes and espouses and has practiced. And beyond it being sort of debilitating as the decades pass, I've been sort of reviewing a lot of private videos I've filmed with my grandparents who both left, fled Palestine in 48 and 67. I think we're making progress as the media gets more decentralized. I think we're seeing shifts in the U.S. amongst younger generations, in particular, a majority of Democrats empathizing with Palestinians. All these statistics are encouraging, but it is still maddening to see the attempts, as you said and alluded to, you know, the censorship that I've witnessed at mainstream news organizations that we're witnessing again with Facebook and other social media platforms. That's why I think it's just important to not be silenced, to continue sharing our stories. I know this seems very like obvious, but 10 years ago at a digital media conference in Texas, I was sitting on a panel when a guy jumped up and he pointed at me and he screamed across the room, "This guy, Ahmed, he's an activist. He's not a journalist." And, you know, his aim was to insult me, to discredit me, as if journalists and activists somehow must be mutually exclusive. And, you know, to me, it seems odd. I mean, a person who campaigns for some kind of social change is an activist, but then a journalist is actually campaigning for change too. Otherwise, why the hell are we sharing stories so that things can stay the same? So the modern notion of objectivity and the way we frame stories, you know, and the construct, especially in Israel and Palestine, of like two equal sides, is a conscious, dangerous disservice to journalism and to the public. There's a lot of news organizations, some of whom I've worked for, like the New York Times, when there's these violent outbursts in terms of how Israel, you know, imposes its occupation and war with Gaza and all of this. You know, the New York Times covers it by saying dozens of Palestinians have died in protests as the U.S. prepares to open its embassy in Jerusalem or whatever. Like, just this very passive, vague normalizing of ethnic cleansing, displacement, apartheid, occupation, all the things that the world's outraged over in Ukraine. You know, like, based on how so much of the media frames Israel and Palestine, it would leave the viewers to wonder, like, do Palestinians just drop dead? I think we should remember that the guise of objectivity sort of tends to serve the interests of those who are among the most privileged. And what we do when we try to balance both sides, like once in a documentary for Vice, while I was in the field in the Philippines reporting, they made me send corrections for a voiceover for a film. And they got my voice saying both sides have suffered massive casualties. And that's just one of the biggest regrets I have from working on that documentary in Israel and Palestine, that they managed to make me even both sides the situation. I mean, there was so much more censorship. And I should say, like, Palestinians at Vice and elsewhere, you know, they're doing incredible work now, and not just Palestinian people, but people who are not Palestinian covering it. We can't forget that journalists were once the gatekeepers of information. And so that's no longer true, you know, where the public had to rely sort of on a handful of authoritative voices that were supposedly objective and almost always white men.
Last but not least, I wanted to discuss with you patriarchy in the Arab world. It has shaped the ways we see masculine and feminine roles in society. But I'm curious to know more about your take on masculinity in the region, knowing that most men grow up to be aggressive and affirm a toxic virility, whereas you were passionate about dancing, you were expressing your emotions, you were always defending women's rights. So, in your opinion, what can we do to refurbish Arab masculinity today?
It's so necessary because it's true that, you know, I was passionate about dancing and expressing my emotions and always defending women's rights since I was a kid. And that's because that's how I was raised and how I was educated. I think, you know, I'm very aware that that's a privilege and I'm grateful for it. But this is why I believe education, connection, interaction as methods to generate empathy in our societies amongst men is so important to create. I also grew up, to be fair, playing soccer and being very competitive in sports and qualifying for the high hurdles. I was very proud to qualify for the Junior Olympics. So, you know, even though I did musical theater and West African dance in high school, all the way through high school, my sister started the first women's soccer team at the American University of Beirut. So I kind of grew up with examples around me in which people were challenging the status quo and equality. To answer your question, I'm so inspired by young people in the Arab world who are kind of bending and blending and blurring the gender roles just by experimentation and by connecting to their sort of authentic selves. Yeah, we're in a very intriguing moment where society is no longer sort of anchored fully in tradition, but it's also not fully anchored in modernity. It's somewhere in between. We really need an accepted version of masculinity that doesn't measure itself by how to dominate and exert our will over other human beings, whether men or women. And I'm counting on the men who I know in their public and private lives who sort of use their privilege and power to sort of blur those lines, to adapt, to learn to create sort of healthier behaviors. And kind of we also need more safe spaces where young men particularly can think critically and consciously about sort of the more harmful, narrow ideas that dictate sort of what a man is. And maybe we can redefine masculinity that way. How can I say, like, there are some cultures like the Tuareg culture, which is sort of matriarchal rather than patriarchal. It's like matrilineal. So like men in this Muslim subset veil their faces while women aren't required to do so. So there is also cultures where like a queen is the leader. And so for me, you know, for me, masculinity, I'm learning more and more, is about owning all of who you are, your vulnerabilities, your insecurities, your confusion, as well as your strength, and sort of bringing that to the table while also being able to empathize, not assume sort of that your assumptions are somehow the foundation for our culture, you know, not thinking of yourself as any less of a man for taking directions or being open to suggestions, looking someone you don't agree with in the eye and actually having a conversation. I think there's a lot of mental health issues, a lot of shame, a lot of issues around sex. I think the real victims of sort of so-called toxic masculinity are actually the men who struggle with fragile masculinity because they're being forced to sort of follow these narrow norms that they can't comply with. So then they become anxious, they leads to depression, they get angry at the world, they get resentful, and they stop thinking for themselves. And then they become followers of all these very toxic leaders, like that guy, Andrew Tate.
Okay, we will wrap this up, but first, in each episode of Gens, we deconstruct together a myth or a lie that I have been told or that I have often heard of. A white Christian guy once told me, I mean, look, you're defending Muslims or hijabis. You claim that everything you're saying is nuanced, but it's not true because you only tell your community one side of the story. My version of the truth should also be considered. What would you have answered if you were me?
Well, I know many men in the Arab world, perhaps unsurprisingly from higher socioeconomic statuses, whom I deeply respect for sort of challenging the myth that being a real man means putting up a false front, disrespecting others, being violent, being self-destructive. They're the ones who inspire me to sort of continue challenging these myths. But I would maybe have said something like, you know, you have to be the change that you want to be or see in the world, I should say. And I think as human beings, the myth of the atomic age is that we need to be able to remake ourselves. So if you change yourself and your attachment to whatever identity it is that's keeping you so closely attached to your truth, quote unquote, you know, your attachment to that identity, if you can let go of that, then you will change your world. You know, if you change how you perceive yourself, you'll change how you feel, you'll change what actions you take. And so the world around you will change too. I mean, that's what I find when I'm in flow and aligned, when I'm open to other people's truths, when I recognize that there is no universal truth, so to speak, and that everything's a matter of perspective. So maybe it's about shifting focus. I would encourage him to shift his focus inward, maybe to be a Sufi, to be a Sufi about it.
My dear Ahmed, thank you very much. Shukran, shukran, shukran for this inspiring discussion.
For sure.
Remember, be it on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Google Podcasts, or else, don't forget to subscribe to Gens Podcast account and to leave your questions and comments. Go subscribe to Gens Podcast on Instagram at JINS_podcast. Don't hesitate to share around every time you listen to an episode, because you should always remember that someone, somewhere, somewhat needs a new light shed on Islam, gender identity, sexualities, Arab origins, or anything that can be prone to oppression. So please do your part and pass the word around.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.